Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Pop Culture Soup, a Cafe Society production. I'm your host, Melissa, or Mel if you're so inclined. Sorry for the delay between episodes. We affectionately refer to this last 2 weeks at my office as Hell Week, now ironically because it used to be a week and now it's more like a half a month. Hell half a month, as we now kind of call it sometimes. In any event, you're going to get at least 3 episodes from me over the next couple of days, so watch out for those. I'll give you more specifics on what's coming up at the end of today's episode. Arr, here be spoilers. What the pirate is trying to say is that while I'll do my best not to spoil too much of the plot, this is not a spoiler-free zone. So if this worries or offends you, turn back now. You have been warned. So today we're going to talk about Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, both the book and the movie versions of the story. But before we start, I want to start with a little bit about Seth Graham Smith, who is the author and the screenwriter. I was introduced to him when I picked up Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, which is a fabulous book. I can't quite remember how I stumbled upon it. I think my brother, who is a poli-sci major at a school in Southern Illinois, I think he's the one that gave it to me. He was really big into Lincoln at that time, and to be fair, I think that's when the Spielberg movie came out, and he goes to a school that actually has a statue of Lincoln on it. So in his defense, it was something that he was sort of surrounded by. He went through a whole phase where he was obsessed with everything Lincoln. But in any event, I read it and I was immediately impressed. I won't spend a lot of time talking about that particular book, except to say that that a lot of it is told through Lincoln's perspective in the form of his journals. I'm using air quotes here because they obviously weren't really Lincoln's journals. But and then there's like supplemental prose thrown in between for outside events like action and dialogue and such. It's so well written that you really feel like you're taking a stroll through President Lincoln's young mind, and it feels like it could have happened in the real world, in the sense that Seth Graham Smith is so good at creating these perfectly formed bubbles of suspension of disbelief that you're like, yeah, that totally fits into history. Geez, maybe he really was a vampire hunter. But in any event, when I discovered that they were going to make a movie out of it, I kept, you know, trying to figure out with that particular story how they were going to translate it onto screen, which is different than Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, because I actually read the book after. But, you know, when I found out that he was going to write the screenplay for Vampire Hunter as well, I was like, okay, well, it's his story, so he'll figure out how to translate it. And what's so great about that particular book and the sister movie that becomes evident in the sensibility of translation that he displays in Pride and Prejudice and Zombies 2 is that Smith has an intense understanding in the difference between books and movies. And we'll talk about this a little bit more in depth a little bit later in the episode, but I want to dig into Jane Austen and Zombies, but I feel like since even though Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, the book came first, the movie version of Vampire Hunter came first. And so I feel like it's sort of relevant to bring up, and we'll talk about it a little bit more later on. Full disclosure here, though I did major in literature and I love books, I admittedly have always struggled with Jane Austen. It's not an intense dislike because I do love Emma, both the book and all of the big and small screen adaptations. And I actually support and approve of Emma Thompson's interpretation of Sense and Sensibility, which fixes the things Jane Austen ruined about that story and the character she ruined about that story. Anyway, I know a bunch of you are probably shutting this off right now. However, I just don't connect with her as an author and her writing style as I do with other writers. I don't think she's a bad writer. I think she's a great writer, but she came from a very specific personal place where, you know, everything was always tied in a nice little bow. Her characters always get to explain themselves, especially the men. And then all of the good, pious, proper girls, whether they're rich or not, always get to marry for love and money. Like, it's just not realistic. And I know that we're talking about a book that was then adapted for zombies, so realism isn't a huge part of it. But I just, yeah, it was hard. When you have, you know, when you go from reading like Middlemarch, which is totally realistic and practical and could have been airlifted right out of English society in the 18th century, like it's just hard. It's hard for me. Now, to be fair, you know, to Jane Austen, though I do like, you know, a little bit of Dickens, and obviously I appreciate Middlemarch, it's a British thing for me. I studied a lot of, you know, I've mentioned before, I was a Fitzgerald scholar, and I studied a lot of American modernists in particular, and so it's very different. Even the British modernists are different, you know, and so I think it's a cultural thing. I think it's so different, you know, the way that they write and the perspective, you know, the cultural perspective is very different. So I have a hard time connecting with British literature in general. That being said, I've always hated Pride and Prejudice, and I know that some of you are probably reaching for the pause button to shut me off, but I do need to be honest about where I'm coming from and what, you know, where I'm really coming at this review from before we dig into the nitty-gritty of this story and this adaptation. Just stick with me. I will say that I went in after I read the book, not so much the movie, but after I read the book, I went and revisited Jane Austen's original book, and I watched the newer movie adaptation of Pride and Prejudice, and then I read about all of the, you know, the beef that people had about the ending of the new Pride and Prejudice movie, the one with Keira Knightley. So, I mean, it did sort of, I will say I appreciate it more, and there are things that I liked about it that I didn't like about it before from reading and watching Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. So, if there's one thing I can say about this whole thing is that it did bring me closer to Jane Austen, so there's that, even though I, you know, she's still not my favorite, so sorry. I have more respect, but I don't have that precious reverence for her works that other people have, so I appreciate that Seth sort of comes at this the same way. Like, he sort of comes at it from this, I have great respect for this story, and, you know, I'm maintaining its integrity, but I don't have a ton of, you know, not just reverence, but also he wasn't precious about changing the original tale to not only adapt it into a book, but also adapt it into the movie. So let's start with the book. I listened to the audiobook version. I mentioned before that that's pretty much the only way I quote unquote read books now. But the book version that I read, and I don't know how different they are, but it was actually the second edition of the book that came out like a year or two later after the original publication. It's aptly titled Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, the Classic Regency Romance, Now with Ultra-Violent Zombie Mayhem. Apparently the printed version of the book has more zombie goodness, and it's also apparently semi-illustrated, so that would be interesting to see and just compare to the visual of the movie adaptation of the way that they did their zombies. So I'm going to have to track a copy of that down, but I don't know how different it is from the original, but this is the version that I read. This version of the book also contains an introduction by the author Seth Graham Smith that explains the why and how he came to this whole thing and offers his reaction to the literary trend. It started back in the late aughts. It started this whole trend of like Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters, and then there were actually a couple of sequels to Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, and there's been a whole slew of, and I've sort of resisted until now, but I may actually get into these. There's actually a whole slew of Darcy being a vampire books that have come out too, so I might have to dip my toe into that pool now that I've got a little bit more appreciation for it, but that's another day. But what was cool about this is, you know, it talks about how basically his editor called him and said, so I have this idea about Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. And Seth Graham Smith was like, yeah, let's do that. I don't even know what that is, but let's do it. And he loved it, and he immediately got a copy of the original book and read it and reread it and made notes and sort of tried to wrap his mind around what he was going to change. And he said, you know, I want to change at least one word on every page. So he actually got a copy of Pride and Prejudice on the internet and put it in a Word document and then just proceeded to go through and literally adapt the original text to this new story, this new version of the story. So I thought that was really cool to hear about, and really cool to kind of get. He reacts a little bit to the literary craze that he started. I think I was just at the end of college when the whole thing started, or just out of college. It was something I didn't get into at the time, so I'm way late, and I think it's over. I'm not really sure. Somebody can clarify that for me, but I'm pretty sure the whole literary craze is over, but it seems to be circling back around. And, you know, I think it's something that actually hurt this movie a little bit, because it didn't do very well. I can tell you right now, I went opening weekend and there were maybe six people in the whole theater. And I live in a major metropolitan area. I was at a theater that's just outside the perimeter in Atlanta. So I can tell you that's not good. That's not good when you go to a movie and there's like six people in there. So I think it kind of hurt this movie, because you're talking about, if the craze started in 2009 and it only lasted a couple of years, and now we're in 2016 and you're releasing this movie, it doesn't have the context that it would have had back then, because now people, you know, are just sort of like, really? Pride and Prejudice and Zombies? Which was what my reaction to the original book was back in 2009. But now, you know, people are so far away from that whole craze again that, you know, they've lost sight of why this might exist. Whereas if it had the context to sort of pad it, people might have been more interested in it. And I also think zombies are sort of going the way of vampires, in the sense that there's such saturation. There's always room for it. There's always room for vampire fiction. There is always room for zombie fiction and stories. But the market is so saturated with zombies right now, I think that people are sort of over it. And so I think people are like, really, one more thing? We don't need one more zombie anything. And so I think that hurt this movie a little bit. Not, you know, it's not a knock at anything, any of the storytelling or anything like that. He's a fabulous writer and he's a fabulous screenwriter, but I just think this was poor timing. It was very poor timing for this movie to come out. But anyway, back to the book. So, you know, the integrity of the story and the speeches that Austinites are so attached to really do retain their original structure. He really doesn't deviate that much. I was really surprised, like, when I went and watched the movie and then I grabbed a copy of the book and, you know, all this stuff, when I was really kind of comparing. I mean, other than adding a word or two here and there to bring it into this whole zombie world, I mean, he really does keep most of her original story. You know, it really is a true adaptation, in the sense that he took her text and just added zombies to it. So I think that's really cool. And I think that's really unique. And it's sort of, it shows a writer that's confident in his abilities and has his ego in check, because I think it's probably really hard to take a work that is viewed with such reverence. I mean, people who don't even love Jane Austen love Pride and Prejudice. And, you know, for him to step into that world and take that book and treat it with the respect and the, you know, the really kid gloves that he held it with, all while, you know, creating this really cool, ridiculous, absurd world, is very cool. And it takes a talented writer to do. So I will say the book was campy and it was fun. It almost, not all the way, but it almost makes me want to read the whole original book, because some of the dialogue, and I believe it of Jane Austen, because again, I have read Austen books. It's so ridiculous. And some of those women, you just want to chuck them off cliffs. Oh, they drive me crazy. Some of her female characters just drive me nuts. I love some of them. Like, I love Emma and I love Eleanor. Maybe it's an E name, but like, she does like E names, because then there's an Elizabeth. Huh, that's funny. I never thought about that before. But yeah, like it's, she drives me crazy. But she, you know, she just, I mean, he writes these, you've got these, the ridiculousness of a Regency English ball back then already. And then you take and you throw these zombies into it. It's just fun. It was really fun. It was campy. And, you know, clearly life in 18th century England would have gone on as normal if the zombie apocalypse had come to play back then. That's really what this teaches us, because it doesn't seem like it really took him that much work to go from what Jane Austen had depicted of 18th century Regency England to 18th century Regency England in the middle of a zombie apocalypse. Pretty much the same thing. So I want to hit the pause button here for just a second. If you remember in my introduction episode to me, I talked a little bit how I have a very specific perspective on the whole vampire versus zombie thing. And I feel like in order to talk about this fairly and really through my filter, I need to flesh that out a little bit more in terms of what my perspective on this whole zombie subsect of supernatural pop culture is. You know, I really struggle with zombie lore. I have never had any trouble getting into vampire fiction. Not even werewolves. Like, werewolves aren't really my favorite, but it's easier for me to get into things like werewolves or vampires or even, you know, pixies or fairies or any other supernatural creature for that matter. You know, when I was really kind of thinking about this, I think it's the hopeless romantic in me that can't find something to hold on to in zombie stories. There's nothing sexy or romantic about zombies, you know, and I think that comes from their lack of humanity. What they end up as is not anything that's close to human. You know, there's something intense and visceral about vampires, you know, with their connection to blood and danger and the imagery of, you know, all the things that those creatures bring to mind. There's this vitality to that lore because of its connection to all of those things. So, you know, it's easy. It's really, you know, it's really easy to sort of get into and get lost in. And, you know, maybe with the exception of the movie Warm Bodies, which is a great indie movie, came out a few years ago, has Nicholas Holt and John Malkovich in it, about what happens when the world falls into a zombie apocalypse. But it's really sweet. It's really cute. It's a little bit of a romance, but it's really, really good. And then iZombie, the TV show on the CW right now, which was also a comic book, there isn't really anything human about them. You know, they don't have personality. It's almost like, I mean, I don't even want to say it's like an animal, because a lot of times in movies, animals have a lot of personality. They have a lot of depth. It's just, this is a creature that doesn't really have any, you know, true depth or true personality. You know, they're always the bad guy to be feared and fought, and you never get beyond, you know, the lore into real characterization. You know, my friends have tried to get me to watch The Walking Dead. Maybe even use my love for Chris Hardwick as a ploy to pull me in. They're like, you know, you can't watch The Walking, you know, you could, if you watch The Walking Dead, you could watch The Talking Dead. And, you know, and then Zachary Levi pops up on that. So, you know, all these people that you love, they do The Talking Dead. So you should watch The Walking Dead. Yeah, it doesn't work. It hasn't worked. I'm not saying, I mean, it may be a show that I would love, and I don't doubt that it is. I know one of my best friends tells me all the time that she doesn't love the show because it's about zombies. She loves the show because it's about the people. And, you know, I believe her, but it's just, it's hard for me to get over that hump of the whole zombie thing. You know, at my core, I think it's because I believe and I trust in the darkness of other lores. You know, there's this humanity to those other creatures that sort of says something. It sort of amplifies the darkness of humanity. And that's something that I trust. It's something that I've seen. It's something that, you know, we can say, okay, really, this exists in the world. And, you know, it's something that you can also divorce yourself from and say, well, not everyone, you know, in the world is evil, and not everyone gives into their deepest, darkest desires. But here's this really fun, specific story that amplifies that idea of the darkness within. And but with zombies, you know, that shit can really happen. At the core, I think that's what bothers me the most, is we could have, like, that's a thing that could happen. You know, I hate when I go to a movie or read a book or I see a TV show where the apocalypse happening could actually happen. You know, movies like Contagion, which wasn't about zombies, but it was about, you know, a disease. You know, World War Z could really happen. What turned the zombies into zombies in World War Z was a mutated strain of rabies. Like, again, I don't know about you, but that makes me intensely uncomfortable. Like, that could really happen. And I think that's what I don't like about zombies, is that there's a part of me that thinks that that could really happen. It's rooted in rationality, even though it's an irrational fear. I get it. But I will stay with my sexy, blood-sucking fantasies of Damon Salvatore and Elijah Michelson. That's all I'm saying. Okay, I digress. Let's move on. Let's talk about the movie adaptation. I think there's this perspective from book lovers that screenwriters need to be precious about the original content in a book. And I'm not saying that this is a right or wrong perspective. I certainly hold this idea in my head when I'm watching certain adaptations of books. I can give you a very recent example. I felt that way about Paper Towns. The way that they changed some of the character relationships, and particularly the ending of that book, to me, wiped out everything about it that made it great. And it was such a flat, just not good adaptation of that book. And that's, you know, that's, I think, one of those things. It's hard to take a literary book and translate it to the screen and change it, because then you're going to get people that really wanted you to be precious about certain things, and they'll get upset because they don't, you know, they're not seeing this visual actualization of it. Or it's the wrong image, because book lovers always create, you know, things in their head. And then when it's translated onto screen and it doesn't look like what they saw in their head, it's hard for them to really love it and hold on to it. Casting Tobey Maguire as Nick Carraway in The Great Gatsby is a good example of that. Leonardo DiCaprio walked out of that book. He is Gatsby perfection. Tobey Maguire was such bad casting, especially after they had Jake Gyllenhaal do the audiobook, and he was so perfect. And then you watch the movie and you were like, but that should have been Jake Gyllenhaal. It should have been Jake Gyllenhaal and Leonardo DiCaprio in this movie. But anyway, again, another digression for another day. But I will say, I also understand and know that the storytelling vehicle of the novel drives very differently than the storytelling vehicle of movies or even television. You know, Seth Graham Smith seems to really get this in a way that translates so well between his books and his movies. You know, he understands that the purpose of both is very different. To use the example of Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, you know, the book version of that book is about Abraham Lincoln. At its core, it's his journals. It's about who he was and that history of him hunting vampires alongside him rising to fame. And the movie version is a vampire slasher movie. It's a fun, you know, grotesque at times, but just gory, action-packed, junk foody vampire slasher movie. And, you know, it's beautifully filmed, and the effects are really done quite well. And it was cast very well. Again, with a lot of people that weren't actually big name actors, people you would recognize as being people that you've seen before, but not like these huge name actors that you're gonna, you know, run out to the theater to see the movie for. You know, with that particular example, his answer to the translation of that book to a movie was that it simply doesn't translate. And I think that's okay too. You know, I think we need to accept that that may be the answer sometimes. So he changed some of the plot points and simplified some of the plot points in his original story just enough to create a really fast-paced vampire caper movie that was just a little bit campy and then super, super fun. And he did the same, you know, for Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. The book is a direct adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. It maintains the ridiculousness of characters and circumstances and, you know, that whole sort of absurdity of Regency society in 18th century England. The movie is a zombie slasher movie set in Austen's version of Britain. That's exactly what it is. It's just a little bit campy, a lot campy in parts, but fun. You know, the genius of Seth Graham Smith is that he has this ability to paint the absurdity of his premise in a completely believable light once he gets you to suspend your disbelief. I mean, he just creates this perfect bubble that you live in his movies where you're like, this is so ridiculous, but it's so good. And, you know, that was sort of the same way. Even though he didn't write the original Dark Shadows, he wrote the screenplay for the Dark Shadows that came out a few years ago with Michelle Pfeiffer and Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter. I think that was directed by Tim Burton. It was either directed or produced by him. But, you know, it was that same thing. There's like this campy edge that you can see, but it doesn't take you so far out of the story that you're like, this is so stupid, I'm shutting it off. Like, you never think as you're watching these completely absurd, sometimes campy, sometimes ridiculous stories that you think it's stupid. Like, that's the thing, is I think that's the line you have to walk with, that is you want to stay just this side of stupid. And he really did that with the movie adaptation of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. Now, in terms of casting, just like Vampire Hunter, the film has a lot of up-and-comers with a few stars that have a dedicated TV following, which I actually found out later about a couple of them. Not cute little Matt Smith, of course. I know he's Doctor Who, even though I don't watch Doctor Who. I'll admit that I wasn't sold on Sam Riley's Mr. Darcy at first. When he first walked on screen, I mean, even I appreciate the complexity and intense sort of box that the idea of a Mr. Darcy has carved out in our pop culture world. You know, I know that he's supposed to have, you know, this sort of debonair impact on the romantic side of you. But I will say, you know, he seemed a little dry, seemed a little flat, without a lot of personality. But as I read the book, you know, and I'm really interested to rewatch the movie when it comes out for this reason. As I read the book, I sort of realized that that's actually how Darcy is. Darcy is a character that is supposed to be just a little bit under being good looking, just a little bit under being the suavest, most debonair man in the room. Like, he's just supposed to be just a little left of perfection, and that is what makes him perfect. And, you know, also that whole, you know, don't judge a book by its cover, you know, the whole prejudicial view of him, you know, perhaps that's the genius of both that book and of them casting Sam Riley, is you judge him, he walks out and you're like, oh, but he's not the, I mean, he's cute, don't get me wrong, he's cute, and he actually gets cuter as the movie goes on, but, you know, you're like, oh, he's not, like, the best-looking guy, and he's not the suavest, and, you know, all that stuff. He's a badass hunter, though, let me tell you, that boy can work a samurai sword, but, you know, all of those things sort of build your affection for him the way that they do for Elizabeth. He actually has really great chemistry with his two closest intimates in the film, one of which is Douglas Booth, who plays Mr. Bingley, who really, to be quite honest with you, even though he was cute, anybody could have played that role. I think anybody probably could have played Jane Bennett too. It was really about Matt Smith and Lily James, who played Elizabeth Bennet, who is the other person that Sam Riley had a lot of chemistry with. And actually, I sat through half of that movie. I might have even sat through the whole thing. I think I actually looked it up after the movie was over, but I'm cocking my head at this girl going, I know her face. Why do I know her face? It's because she's Cinderella. That's why I know her face. This was such a departure from that role. She's so badass. She's so great. She was great casting for this. And she and Sam Riley have so much chemistry. You know, as you see more of these two relationships build, like I said before, your affection for Riley's Mr. Darcy grows along with everybody else's. You know, I would like to think that they did this on purpose in the movie so that you see Darcy in the same light as Elizabeth does, and that your affection for him wanes and grows along with hers, because there are times in the movie where you really love him, and then times in the movie where you're mad at him like she is, and then times in the movie where you, like, your feelings are sort of complicated and you're like, do I love him? Do I hate him? Do I both? You know, so I would like to think that they did that on purpose. Perhaps the best and most intense divergence from Jane Austen's original story is Smith's version of Darcy's aunt, Lady Catherine de Bourgh. He makes this change in the book as well. You know, in the book, she's this zombie slayer that has studied under the greatest masters in Japan, and you know, she's got all of, you know, she's just this amazing. She's got these ninjas. She's got this like gaggle of ninjas that come around with her, and she has all these war stories. But she's really kind of the same in the book. Like, she's still that, you know, that judgmental aunt that, because she has the most money of everybody, thinks she also should have the most weight in her opinion of everybody else's life. But in the movie, she's played by Lena Headey, who, you know, he really amps it up. He really, really amps up her. She might be the campiest and most ridiculous thing in this whole movie. She's played by Lena Headey, who some of you might know from Game of Thrones. Or if you are an early aughts movie whore like me, from Gossip, which you should watch immediately after this podcast if you haven't seen it already. She was also on the Sarah Connor Chronicles, which I think was a CW show. I don't think that was a WB show. I think that was after they changed to the CW. And I also think she was the wife of whoever Jared Butler plays in 300, but I've never seen those movies all the way through, so I can't tell you if that's true or not. She's just awesome. But she plays a pretty cool character in Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. She's still the same zombie slayer. And in the movie, she wears an eye patch, which is so funny. It's so funny that she wears this eye patch. And she has these paintings in her house that, like, put her into famous scenes in history and famous scenes from the Bible. So there's one of, like, her as Joan of Arc. And there's another one that's, like, her slaying the four horsemen, the four zombie horsemen of the apocalypse. Like, it's so funny. It is just, it's so just very, very funny. She's just hysterical. Part of Smith's conceit in this Austen version of a zombie world is that all the sons and daughters of the Regency Society in Britain are sent abroad to study with Asian masters in the art of fighting. The Bennets have a dojo, for example. They have a dojo on their property, and the girls, you know, when they're not hobnobbing at balls and trying to find husbands, they're training. I mean, they're really, really training. And it's apparent early on in multiple settings that Japan is seen as the superior place to be taught, and that the methods in China are far below those that are taught in Japan. The Bennets, who all trained in China, are looked down upon. in this society for their, you know, inferior and almost pitiable training that they got, even though it also becomes clear pretty early on that all of the Bennett girls are some of the best slayers in this society, and that Elizabeth Bennett is the biggest badass of them all. And in fact, in the book, she's almost this like cold-hearted killer who fantasizes about ripping people's hearts out all the time. I was kind of glad that they changed that, because the intensity of her sort of sociopathic perspective on fighting in the book was a little much for me. But so the, you know, the Bennetts, there's just these really cool, like, one of the things that makes this movie so cool and also amps up, like, it doesn't, you know, it's not trying to be something it's not. This is not a Jane Austen movie. This is a zombie movie. So it has all these really cool sequences, you know, not just fighting sequences, but there's, you know, there's this whole scene where the Bennett sisters are getting dressed to go to a ball. And in their flurry of lace and corsets and all of this, you see them also putting on, you know, their knives into their garters and packing all of their weapons. And it's really cool. And you know what, this addition of all of this training and, you know, this sort of war world that they live in does to this version of the story is it brings this fascinating feminist perspective that I don't see in Jane Austen's original text. I mean, her women have a little more backbone than they had back in those days, so they are a little bit ahead of her time, but they still fit into a very definite, very specific box. So I'm not trying to start an argument. I'm not trying to write a literary text, but I will say that I do think this adds this really cool modern feminist twist to this story. You know, while Mrs. Bennett would love nothing more than for all of her daughters to marry these rich men, regardless of how they treat them, if it's going to secure their financial future, you know, their father is far less interested in that tradition and finds their training way more important. You know, he doesn't care if they don't know how to cook, because if they're not going to survive long enough to be a wife, then what difference does it make if they know how to cook? It's kind of his perspective on it. I think that's really, really cool. Of course, end score, it's still this badass fighting movie. So, I mean, it is fun. It was a really fun movie. You know, it really defines this movie. Like, all these myriad of weapons and the lace and everything that's a part of this. But I really like that it does have this nice sociological exploratory quality buried deep, deep down in the glut of the blood and the guts and the sword fighting. I do really, really appreciate that about the movie. There are two specific actors and two specific characters in this movie that I do think are worth singling out and worth mentioning that aren't part of, well, one of them is sort of part of the main cast. The other one is sort of a peripheral character. But the first one I mentioned before is Doctor Who's Matt Smith, who plays Parson Collins, the Bennett slimy cousin who stands to inherit all of Mr. Bennett's estate if the girls don't marry properly. And it's a total, this character in the movie is a total departure from the plot of the original. Smith uses Collins in the movie to almost uphold the original misogynist perspective in this era from the men. You know, he always dwells in the old concept of women bearing children and cooking dinner. And at one point he proposes to Elizabeth, and the first words out of his mouth are, "Well, you can't fight anymore though. Like that can't happen. Once we get married, you've got to, you know, hang up your sword." And he's normally so adorable. Like he's such a cutie. And as Doctor Who, he really was, you know, like, just this nerdy, sweet character. he's so gross in this movie. Like, the way that they styled him is gross. The way he acts is gross. The things that come out of his mouth just make you want to scrub him. Like, he's just... He's so bad. Like, it makes you want to shower. He's that slimy. But he's also really funny and really awkward, and he adds these really funny sort of one-liners to these very intense, serious situations that are, you know, that are not sort of gratuitous, but actually are very, very funny. So he was a great addition, even though he wasn't necessarily like a main integral character. He was a very good addition to the story. The other actor I have actually moved recently to the top of my watch list, and his name is Jack Houston. He's actually been kind of riding under the radar for a while. He had a role in Boardwalk Empire, which I didn't watch, so I can't comment on if he was good in that or not. He was in American Hustle. He's slowly sort of picking up steam as time goes on. You know, arguably, I think he actually might be the best actor in this bunch that were in this movie. He's part of the Houston family, so he's Hollywood royalty. He's the grandson of director John Houston, and he's Angelica Houston's nephew. But he has a very Austin-esque sensibility about him, and his acting is something that I really connect with, and I really enjoy him. I enjoy watching him on screen. He has this sort of magnetism about him. I'm trying to think of somebody that he's sort of akin to, almost like, you know, he's actually not that far from Colin Firth. Maybe that's why I like him so much, because I really like, I enjoy Colin Firth when he's on screen. He's not necessarily like the best looking guy, but he's not a bad looking guy by any means, and he's a great actor. So maybe that's why I like him so much, because he does remind me a little bit of that. I actually first saw him last year. The first thing I ever saw him in was The Longest Ride, which, even though it's a Nicholas Sparks book, was actually a really good movie. I normally don't go into those things with very high hopes, and I walked out going, huh. So, but he had to play the young version of Alan Alda in that, which, you know, it's not a, that's not a small order to be playing any version of Alan Alda. So he was great in that movie, and I was actually pleasantly surprised. I didn't know he was in Pride and Prejudice and Zombies until he came on screen, and I was pleasantly surprised to see him pop up. He has a bunch of projects coming up, if anybody's interested. He's going to play in, I didn't know they were doing this, but apparently they're remaking Ben-Hur, and he's going to play Ben-Hur. In Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, if anybody's familiar with the original Pride and Prejudice, he plays George Wickham, who is Darcy's great, you know, great rival. He's a soldier as well, and he was Darcy's father's surrogate son, so they sort of grew up as these rival brothers, and he catches Elizabeth's fancy as this good-looking man who says all the right things. Now, in the book, Elizabeth's fascination with Wickham is very short-lived and almost completely insignificant, but in the movie, he plays the embodiment of her inner ideological conflict with fighting the zombies and fighting in the zombie war. You know, Wickham wants to make peace with the zombies by teaching them to eat pig's brains rather than human brains, and, you know, sort of calling a truce with the ones that can be reasoned with. Now, what I will say to this is religious piety and self-control are always the way to end a war, and abstinence-only education always works, right? I'm being sarcastic about it now, but I actually found myself having a momentary but intense inner debate about this part of the film. It actually sort of made me uncomfortable because Wickham brings up what I'll call the vampire argument, where you live in harmony with these dark creatures as long as they don't eat and kill humans, which is, if you watch any vampire, werewolf, anything, that's always one of the, well, not always, but for the most part, it's usually some kind of plot point where they say, you know, if we can figure out a way to do this, we can move forward, because, you know, we have to figure out how to coexist or we're just going to kill each other off. You know, and though you're supposed to see Darcy as the hero, I was actually almost mad at him. There's this part in the movie, and this is a spoiler, where he's going to save Lydia Bennett, and he feeds these peaceful, pious zombies brains, And I was almost mad at him. I was almost like, but they were fine and they weren't eating humans. And they were just going about their business and, you know, they were living their lives. And how could you, you know, and that may be part of this movie from a story perspective that bothers me, because, you know, when the twist is revealed in the final fight, which I won't give away, that is one thing I won't spoil, because I actually thought, even though I sort of saw it coming, I actually thought it was sort of genius as well. This ideological argument sort of becomes unimportant because they give it so much weight in the middle of this movie that I thought, oh, this is going to come back and Elizabeth is really going to grapple with this idea. And she sort of does, but then she also sort of drops it. It's like when Wickham becomes invalidated in her mind, so does that ideology, and she just lets it go. And I don't know, it didn't feel like it was properly wrapped up, so to speak. It's just sort of dropped. So that is one criticism I will give to the plot of the movie. Okay, final thoughts. This film is just fun. It's lighthearted, zombie mayhem. It's got some, you know, great sort of period piece costuming. And it actually made me think a little bit of A Knight's Tale, because I remember watching the behind the scenes stuff on A Knight's Tale, which is a movie with Heath Ledger that takes place in the Middle Ages, and them talking about how they specifically styled them to sort of be rock starry. Like they always look like they always wear chaps, but they always sort of look like they were wearing leather pants and leather jackets. And you know, they made a concerted effort to make them look sort of young and hip. And that's how this movie is styled too. So I thought that was really fun. You know, Darcy always wears this big, long black trench coat, almost this matrixy leather black trench coat. And, you know, as long as you're not expecting a true reverent adaptation of a Jane Austen book, you'll love it. Like it's so fun. It's just gratuitous violence. There's actually not a severe amount of gore to the movie. It's certainly not like there was in Vampire Hunter. It's very violent, but I actually think it was only rated PG-13. I think Vampire Hunter might have been an R. But it's not actually super gory. The zombies are gory enough. They're pretty creepy looking. Like almost that when the first zombie you see in the movie doesn't really look like a zombie. The first zombie that you see in the movie that actually looks like a zombie actually elicited like a visceral response from me. Like I actually sort of recoiled when she came on screen. And I think that's the mark of good design. So it was actually kind of impressive. I can't wait to see what Seth is going to do next. I love his books, you know, I think he's a great writer, and he's working on, he's actually the screenwriter for the Beetlejuice sequel. Oh crap. And there was one more thing that he's working on right now that I can't think of off the top of my head that I was excited he was going to be a part of that project too. I think it was another remake. It was either another remake or another adaptation, but it was, he's just great. I think he's the perfect person to write the Beetlejuice sequel. So I'm excited to see what he does with that. But on a side note, I also want to plug the sequel to Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. It's called The Last American Vampire. And I can honestly say that it is one of the best books I've ever read in any genre, not just vampire fiction, but in any genre. I mean, obviously it's vampire fiction, but it's also historical fiction. He manages to connect every major American historical event from Roanoke and Jamestown to Bill Clinton's presidency in this book, all through vampire history. And he throws in some other fun international things like Jack the Ripper. And it's really smart. It's very, very thoroughly researched. It's really fun. It's genius. It's a total page turner. I would definitely say, even though it's not like a direct connect from Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter to this one, I would definitely recommend that you read it first, because it's about Henry, who is the vampire that sort of coaches him and teaches him in that book. But, you know, prepare yourself for an amazing amazing experience, because it's so good. I don't think they're going to turn it into a movie. I wouldn't expect them to, but, you know, seeing Dominic Cooper in my head play Henry in the sequel was really cool. Like, I think that was very well cast. So highly, highly recommend it. All right, that's all from Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. I'd love to hear what you guys think of it when you've seen it, you know, if you've seen it, when you read the book, what you thought of the book, what you thought of the two compared. Same with Vampire Hunter. If you want to give me your thoughts on that, I'd love to hear them. I want to apologize again for the considerable length of time between episodes and kind of give you a preview of what's coming up. I'll have a similar review of the Oscar-nominated film The Revenant in the next couple of days. I was going to try and watch all of the Oscar movies, but I just don't think I'm going to have time, but I'm going to do my best. I'll also get my semi-weekly episode about the Serial podcast. I had actually intended to get that out Friday, but Sarah Koenig has decided she's going to be unpredictable this season, and she was like, oh yeah, by the way, there's another episode. So I wanted to make sure I could talk about both of those together. And then I also got a chance to listen to Crime Writers On today too. So I want to kind of talk about some of the points that they brought up and a little bit too. I'm also going to have an album review of the new Lake Street Dive album, which I've heard a little bit of. I haven't had a chance to really sit down and consume that the way that I want to, but it sounds really good so far. And then I'm also going to do a whole episode about podcasts coming up here in the next couple of weeks. At some point, I am going to curate a marathon I will share with you on the blog of what it's going to entail, but it's going to be all Alan Rickman movies, and then I'll discuss them on a future episode. That being said, I can't give you an exact release date for that because I'm still sort of wrapping my head around his passing. I don't feel like I'm quite emotionally ready to go there. I actually, the day after he died, I got a whole bunch of his movies out and I sat them by the DVD player and just sort of looked at them and looked at the DVD player and I was like, nope, I can't do this. So when I feel like I'm ready, I'm going to broach it and then we're going to talk about him because he's one of my favorite actors ever. I think everybody, he's one of those actors, sort of iconic the way that Bowie was in the sense that everybody has a different Bowie that they loved. Everybody has a different Alan Rickman that he loved. To a whole generation of kids, he was Professor Snape, but like to me, he was Colonel Brandon, which I know is ironic given how much I just shit all over Jane Austen, but that being said, he was still my Colonel Brandon. And, you know, so I really want to give him a proper, you know, a proper tribute in that regard. If there's anything you would like to see me explore, anything you guys are interested in that you'd like to see an episode about, please drop me a line and let me know. Our website is acafesociety.com. You can find all the links and sources for today's episode at the blog hosted on the A Cafe Society site. You can also drop me a line via email at acafesocietypodcast@gmail.com or hit me up on Twitter at acafesociety. If you like what you're hearing or if you want to leave us some suggestions and feedback, please leave us a review on iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice. This helps us out so much and it makes it so other people can find us. If you want a weekly dose of adorableness, you can also follow the adventures of my dogs on Instagram at Casey and Oscar. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Stay safe and awesome, everyone. This podcast is a production of A Cafe Society and written and produced by me, Melissa Robertson, with sound design by my incredibly talented brother, Riley Robertson. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll catch you next time.